Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 29, which I will entitle Prophecy Against Egypt. We start now in verse 1. In the 10th year, in the 10th month, on the 12th day, the word of the Lord came to me. So this is the date of the prophecy. The 10th year means the 10th year from Jehoiachin's captivity and Ezekiel's captivity, which was in 597, the year that Zedekiah was put on the throne of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. So 597 minus 10 for the 10th year gets you right around 587. Precept Austin, my source for dating, has it at 586, close enough. The interesting thing about this date is that it's 1 year earlier than the prophecies against Tyre, which happened in the previous chapter or chapters. We read in Ezekiel 26:1, in the 11th year on the first day of the month, that was the prophecy against Tyre. Against Egypt is in the 10th year. We wonder why the prophecy against Egypt, even though earlier, is placed later in the book. The answer, according to one commentator, is because the prophecy against Egypt is fulfilled after the prophecy against Tyre. Tyre went down in 573 BC. Egypt is going down, and it's very controversial, as we'll see, but at least by 525 BC, when the Persians took over Egypt and beat Egypt under Cambyses. And so this prophecy is given. Now we'll say 587 or so in the 10th month. That's the month of Tebet, December or January. We go now to verse 2 and read through verse 5. Son of man, set your face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and prophesy against him, against all Egypt. Speak to him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you great monster lying among your streams. You say the Nile is mine. I made it for myself. But I will put hooks in your jaws and make the fish of your streams stick to your scales. I will pull you out from among your streams with all the fish sticking to your scales. I will leave you in the desert, you and all the fish of your streams. You will fall on the open field and not be gathered or picked up. I will give you as food to the beasts of the earth and birds of the air. Now in verse 2, Yahweh calls Ezekiel son of man. He does this every chapter. Two possible theories. First theory is that Ezekiel is said to have the characteristics of a man because he's the son of man. What are those characteristics? Men are fallible, they're weak, they're stupid, they're ignorant, they're foolish. And so God is trying to keep Ezekiel humble as he gives them all of these exalted prophecies. The other theory is that Yahweh is actually creating Ezekiel as a type of Jesus, who was the Son of Man. He called himself that all the way through the Gospels. Jesus took the phrase from Daniel 7:14, the Son of Man ascended up to the Ancient of Days, and all the Old Testament Jews understood that to be the Messiah, and so Jesus took that term, Son of Man, to prove that he was the Messiah. How is Ezekiel a type of Jesus, the antitype? Well, Ezekiel was preaching against a rebellious house of Israel and was predicting the destruction of their capital city, Jerusalem, and the temple contained therein. Likewise, Jesus prophesied against the rebellious house of Israel and also prophesied against their city and the temple contained therein. He did that on the Mount of Olives in the Olivet Discourse when he said not one stone of that temple would be left lying upon another. So in verse 2, Yahweh says, Son of man, set your face against Pharaoh. Now, which Pharaoh is this? This is Pharaoh Hophra. He ruled from 589 to 570. Now, this Pharaoh Hophra is also called Apries, A-P-R-I-E-S. Let me read you what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about Pharaoh Hophra, also known as Apries. His reign began prosperously. He took Gaza and Sidon and made himself master of Phoenician Palestine, recovering much that was lost to Egypt by the victory of Nebuchadnezzar at Carchemish. That was in 605. So proudly secure because of his successes for 25 years did he feel that he said not even a god could deprive him of his kingdom, as Herodotus reports. Hence the appropriateness of the description of him in Ezekiel 29:3. Ezekiel 29:3 says, You are a great monster, Hophra. No mere human sagacity could have enabled Ezekiel to foresee Egypt's downfall in the height of its prosperity. Now in verse 3, God calls Hophra a great monster, probably referring to a crocodile. In fact, Gill says Pharaoh in the Arabic language signifies a crocodile. Now, I don't know about that because I don't know Arabic. One of my commentators says that a crocodile is almost peculiar to Egypt. Well, he hasn't been to South Carolina or Florida yet, I assume. But crocodile's a nasty beast. I've seen them up close. Ooh, you don't want to mess with a crocodile. They are great monsters. Lying among your streams, that would be the seven branches of the Nile, most probably. Yahweh says to Hophra, you say the Nile is mine, I made it for myself. That's referring to the fact that Hophra had cut canals into the branches of the Nile for irrigation. All the pharaohs did that. But Yahweh says, I'm going to put hooks in your jaws, Hophra. A hook in the jaw refers to the ancient way of taking and destroying crocodiles. And then Yahweh says, I'm going to make the fish of your streams stick to your scales. I assume that actually happened with crocodiles. I don't know. I've never seen it, but I would think that would not be impossible. Who do the fish refer to metaphorically? Here's some options. Option number one, the common people of Egypt. This position is held by Gil Ellicott and Kyle and Delich, and also Clark, who says this. Most fish, he means crocodiles, are sorely troubled with a species of insect which bury their heads in their flesh under their scales and suck out the vital juices. The allusion seems to be to this. Pharaoh was the crocodile, the fish the common people, and the sticking to his scales the insurrection by which Hophra was wasted and despoiled of his kingdom. We'll talk about what happened to Hophra in just a little bit. But according to Clark, the fish are just the people of Egypt. Option number two, as suggested by the pulpit commentary, the fish stuck to the scales of the crocodile are the Egyptian army who are going to be destroyed along with Hophra. Option number three, this is another option from the pulpit commentary, the fish are nations who had allied themselves with Egypt. And of course, they're going to be taken down with Egypt. Now in verse 5, Yahweh says to Hophra, you will fall on the open field and not be gathered or picked up. I will give you as food to the beasts of the earth and the birds of the air. Now we'll see later on that Hophra was not actually killed in the relevant battle, but his army was defeated badly. And so Gil says of that, this fall is referring to the army falling. The Pharaoh just stands for the army. John Gil says, for what is proper to an army is sometimes ascribed to the head or general of it, which fell by the sword in the fields of Libya and Cyrene, and was so discomfited that the remains of it could not be brought and gathered together again. Again, we're going to talk about the battle when Hophra got beat later on, just a little bit. We go now to Ezekiel 29, verses 6 through 7. Then all who live in Egypt will know that I am the Lord. You have been a staff of reed for the house of Israel. When they grasped you with their hands, you splintered, and you tore open their shoulders. When they leaned on you, you broke, and their backs were wrenched. Sounds like my back. What does this mean? Egypt is a reed. Option number one, Egyptians were weak. They could not help the people of Israel when Israel applied to Egypt for help. Option number two, Egyptians were treacherous and deceitful. The Egyptians would not assist the Israelites according to agreements made between them. The Egyptians were even pernicious and hurtful to the Israelites as a broken reed. Option number three, both of the above, the Egyptians were not only weak, but they were treacherous and deceitful. As Adam Clark says, they were an inefficient and faithless ally. The Israelites expected assistance from them when Nebuchadnezzar came against Jerusalem. That was in 588. And they made a feint to help them. Hophra did. But Hophra retired when Nebuchadnezzar went against them. Thus were the Jews deceived and ultimately ruined. Now, we've talked about all that in the book of Jeremiah. Zedekiah had made a deal. Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, had made a deal with Hophra. Please help us. And so Nebuchadnezzar had to temporarily lift his siege of Jerusalem and go deal with Hophra and then come back and continue the siege of Jerusalem. And it didn't take long because Hophra skedaddled when Nebuchadnezzar approached. Apparently, nothing happened in the way of assistance for Judah. We go now to Ezekiel 29, verses 8 through 10. Yahweh continues, therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Now, sovereign is the adjective that the Lord uses to describe himself all the way through the book of Ezekiel. And the point is he's in control of history. We're talking about history here, which kingdom is going to win, which kingdom is going to lose. God is sovereign behind it all. And the sovereign Lord says, I will bring a sword against you, Hophra, and kill your men and their animals. Egypt will become a desolate wasteland. Then they will know that I am the Lord, because you said the Nile is mine, I made it. In other words, by cutting canals off between the tributaries. Therefore, I am against you and against your streams, and I will make the land of Egypt a ruin and a desolate waste from Migdol to Aswan, as far as the border of Cush. Now, we're getting into a part of Ezekiel's prophecy that has got to be, from my point of view, one of the hardest passages of Scripture to interpret. I've gotten through the book of Revelation. I don't have any problem with that anymore, the Olivet Discourse, all that eschatology, but I'm going to have a hard time getting through Ezekiel 29. So we'll give it our best shot. In verse 8, Yahweh says, I will bring a sword against you and kill your men and your animals. Now, this is a civil war, as John Gale says, occasioned by the murmurs of the people on account of the defeat of their army at Cyrene, which issued in the dethroning and strangling of this king as before observed in setting up another. Now, we'll talk about that in a minute. I've got a good description of Hafer's attack into Libya. That's where Cyrene is, Libya, present-day Libya. And he got whopped. And when he got beat, he retreated, and he was either taken into prisoner or he was assassinated. He was either killed in the war or he was assassinated later on when the people had decided they'd had it and they wanted a new king, which they got in 570 when the Pharaoh Amasis II took over. Now, Yahweh says in verse 10 that he will make Egypt a desolate waste from Migdol to Aswan. Migdol, as Wikipedia says, is a Hebrew word which means either a tower from its size or height, an elevated stage, a rostrum or pulpit, or a raised bed within a river. Physically, it can mean a fortified land, i.e. a walled city or castle, or elevated land, as in a raised bed like a platform, possibly a lookout. Figuratively, it has connotations of proud authority. Well, it's a place somewhere in the north. Aswan is far in the south. Its old name was Syene, S-Y-E-N-E. King James actually translates it that way. Adam Clark says, Syene, now called Aswan, was the last city in Egypt. It's called Aswan in the NIV. That's the modern name for it. Going towards Ethiopia, all right? So if you're the far south of Egypt, right before you get to Ethiopia on the Nile River, it's somewhere near the first cataract, near the Elephantine Island down there. Syene, Adam Clark says, was famous for a well into which the rays of the sun fell perpendicularly at midday. Now that's interesting because when I was in Shantou, China, there was a structure built with a roof and a hole in the middle of a stone at the apex of that roof. And it was said on the summer equinox that if you stand under that hole, the sun would shine on you and you would cast absolutely no shadow. And so, of course, I had to go down there and try it out. It was a short bike ride away from my university and went down there. And sure enough, the sun would shine on you and there was no shadow at all. Shantou was near the tropics. In fact, I think it was in the tropics, at the northern end of the tropics. So when you get down there toward the south, the shadows get shorter. But at any rate, this is Aswan. The famous commentator Grotius translates this verse from Migdol, a fortress near Pelusium on the north of Suez, the Suez Canal between the Mediterranean and the Gulf of Suez. It's where the Suez Canal is now. Back then, it was just a place where there were a lot of lakes, and there was a fortress near there, and there was a famous city near there named Pelusium. So this is where Migdol is. So Grotius says basically what Yahweh is saying here, from one end of Egypt to the other, from Migdol in the north to Aswan in the south. Wikipedia says that Aswan is the ancient city of Swenet, later known as Syene, which in antiquity was the frontier town of ancient Egypt facing the south. Now we're going to see later on that the land of Egypt, as is stated in verse 10, is going to be made a desolate waste. It's going to be for 40 years. And now here is where the difficulty begins. We start in verses 11 and 12 of Ezekiel 29. No foot of man or animal will pass through it, from Migdol to Aswan, through Egypt. No foot of man or animal will pass through it. No one will live there for 40 years. I will make the land of Egypt desolate among devastated lands, and her cities will lie desolate 40 years among ruined cities. And I will disperse the Egyptians among the nations and scatter them through the countries. Now, the reason this is difficult is because there is no secular history backing up such a 40-year devastation of Egypt. there's no secular history that contradicts it either. And so when you have a situation like this, in my humble opinion, we just need to take the words of Ezekiel as true and say that it happened, even though we can't prove that it happened. There are some indications that it happened, and I will show you those in just a minute. Now, let's take the phrase in verse 11, no foot of man or animal will pass through it. John Gill says this must be understood not strictly, but with some limitation. It cannot be thought that Egypt was so depopulated as that there should not be a single passenger in it, but that there should be few inhabitants in it, or that there should be scarce any that should come into it for traffic. It should not be frequented as it had been. At least there should be very few that traveled in it in comparison of what had, which is a fancy way of saying that there's not going to be a lot of people in it. There's a lot of exaggeration in Hebrew writing. Not a single foot of a man will pass through it. It just means the place is desolated. It doesn't mean that some poor beggar might be stumbling through the land at some time. Now, Jeremiah had also promised disaster to the Egyptians. We read in Jeremiah 43, verses 8 through 13. Then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah at Tapanhes. That's in the northeastern extremity of Egypt. Pick up some large stones and set them in the mortar of the brick pavement that is at the opening of Pharaoh's palace at Tapanhes. Do this in the sight of the Judean men. These are the Judean exiles who were leaving Jerusalem because they were scared the Babylonians were going to punish them for some civil commotion that they had been involved in. Tell the Judeans, this is what the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, says. I will send for my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and I will place his throne on these stones that I have embedded, and he will pitch his pavilion over them. He will come and strike down the land of Egypt, those destined for death to death, those destined for captivity to captivity, and those destined for the sword to the sword. I will kindle a fire in the temples of Egypt's gods, and he will burn them and take them prisoner. He will clean the land of Egypt as a shepherd picks lice off his garment, and he will leave there unscathed. He will smash the sacred pillars of the sun temple in the land of Egypt and burn down the temples of the Egyptian gods. Secular history says that didn't happen. We don't have a record of that. Now we have another problem in verse 11. This desolate land will be desolate for 40 years. No one will live there for 40 years. The dating is very problematic. That coupled with the fact that there's no clear record of Nebuchadnezzar whacking Egypt has led a certain P. Thompson in biblicalstudies.org.uk to say this. This prophecy of the conquest of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar, thus confidently made both by Jeremiah and by Ezekiel, has long been regarded by those who take delight in such things as an unmistakable instance of the failure of prophetic foresight. In other words, the liberals get all excited about this so they can disprove the inerrancy of the scriptures. Now, the dating of this 40 years is very problematic. First of all, looking at the begin date, a possible begin date, Nebuchadnezzar may or may not have invaded Egypt in 568. Now, there are some inscriptions that say that he did, and I'm going to take that as the beginning date of the 40 years. Here's what Wikipedia says about this possible invasion of Egypt in 568. It is possible that Nebuchadnezzar campaigned against Egypt in 568 BC, given that a fragmentary Babylonian inscription, given the modern designation BM33041, from that year records the word Egypt as well as possible traces of the name Amasis, the name of the then incumbent pharaoh Amasis II. He took over in 570, ruled all the way down to 526. A stele of Amasis, also fragmentary, may also describe a combined naval and land attack by the Babylonians. The evidence for this campaign is scant, however, and the readings of the relevant inscriptions are not certain. If Nebuchadnezzar did campaign against Egypt again, he was unsuccessful again, given that Egypt did not come under Babylonian rule. So you see, there is some evidence, but people are skeptical that Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, did that much to Egypt. They might admit that Babylon came against Egypt, but they don't think that Babylon wiped out Egypt, as Ezekiel is prophesying here. And so they say the prophecy is no good. Now, there is a gentleman who wrote a master's thesis, a four-volume work on this very problem. He dates the invasion of Egypt by Babylon in 564, which is 4 years later than 568, the date that Wikipedia, also the Metropolitan Museum, of New York City. They say 568 is when Babylon may or may not have come. But Jim Riley has written something that's so complex, I read the beginning of his thesis, and he says, if you're going to read this, you have got to master the traditional chronology of Egypt. You've got to master my alternative chronology. This will not be easy reading. And believe me, I didn't read it. But I will tell you that his date is 564. Well, that's the possible beginning of the 40 years of desolation promised to Egypt. How about the end date? That's a little bit easier. It's probably 525, a well-established date when Cambyses of Persia conquered Egypt and the Persians wiped out the Egyptians. So if you take 568 minus 40, you get 528. That's a little bit early. It's fairly close, though, to 525 when Cambyses took over, given the rickety nature of the dating schemes of Egypt. So tentatively, I will take those 40 years there between roughly 568 to 525. 564 to 525, Jim Riley's date is right on the money. 564 minus 40 is 524, which, of course, is within our two-year typical date range. Well, let's look and see how people have tried to interpret this. Conservatives who believe in the integrity of Ezekiel's prophecy. There are several approaches. The first approach is what I call a preterist approach. Those who hold this view say that the prophecy was fulfilled back in the past, near Ezekiel's time. And then there's the futurist approach, which says it's somewhere way off in the future where we have nuclear bombs and radioactivity, and you're familiar with that. Now, both of those are literal fulfillments. One is a literal fulfillment at the time of Ezekiel, and another is a literal fulfillment sometime in the far distant future. But then we have other possibilities. Some people say that the whole 40-year deal is symbolic. 40 is used often as a time of trouble, 40 years in the wilderness. Jesus was tempted for 40 days and so forth. It rained 40 days and 40 nights with Noah's flood and so forth. And so all of this is said to be symbolic, a time of destruction on Egypt. So we have literal fulfillments or options, symbolic options. And three, people say that the prophecy is conditional, that Egypt repented before the 40 years of desolation came upon them. So let's look at these three possibilities. Actually, it's probably four if you split the literal options into preterist and futurist. Let's take the preterist views first. We'll start with Josephus. Now, this quotation I'm going to give you is by P. Thompson, who wrote in an article on biblical studies, biblicalstudies.org.uk. He says this, "The only writer of antiquity who makes any mention of such a conquest is Josephus. He avers that all took place exactly as predicted, that after subduing Coelesyria, that's present-day Lebanon, Phoenicia, Ammon, east of the Jordan River, Moab, east of the Dead Sea, Nebuchadnezzar made an expedition against Egypt, wasted the whole country, slew the reigning king, set up another in his room, in his place, and carried off the Israelite fugitives to Babylon." The Israelite fugitives who had fled after the 586 destruction of Jerusalem, they had fled to Egypt. P. Thompson continues, "But it was easy to argue that Josephus or his Jewish authorities had merely invented the history because they knew of the prophecy. Herodotus and Diodorus Siculus, the unprejudiced historians, made no mention of any such humiliation of Egypt." Well, we could just believe Josephus and that'd be the end of it. Here's another piece of evidence, again from P. Thompson. This refers to a hieroglyphic inscription in the Louvre Museum in Paris, which brings us unimpeachable testimony from a contemporary Egyptian source to the fact of an actual conquest of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar. Herodotus is found to have been not unprejudiced, but merely ill-informed. The Egyptian priest who narrated their country's history to him had taken very good care not to mention their own defeats. If you recall, Herodotus traveled from Greece and he went down to Egypt and started inquiring of everybody about their ancient history, and the Egyptians would talk to him, and he wrote it down. Herodotus did. Well, they didn't mention Nebuchadnezzar beating the mud out of him. Why? Well, because it was embarrassing. So here's this inscription that was found in the Louvre. It was written by a high-ranking official of the pharaoh Hofra, who died in 570. His son, Amasis, not his son, a general, his general, Amasis II, took over in 570, and this official mentions Hofra as his pharaoh, but the official lived longer, could have easily lived longer than Hofra, and he could be referring to something that happened in the time of Amasis II. Remember, we think that the invasion by Babylon of Egypt was somewhere around 568, maybe 564. That's the time of Amasis II, and this is what's being referred to in this inscription. And the inscription said this, "I have caused my statue to be prepared, through which my name shall be immortal, never to be destroyed in this temple, because I repaired the temple when it was wasted by the attack of the Amu and all the wretched northerners from the land of Sati." Now, Amu is Palestinians, and Sati is the Mesopotamian Valley. This official had to repair a temple, and we'll see later on in the inscription, the temple was very near Aswan, very near to the southern border of Egypt. Now, if the temple had to be repaired because of invasions by people from the Mesopotamian Valley, that means that that army must have been successful because it burnt down the temple. So this is good evidence that this is Nebuchadnezzar coming on down to the south of Egypt. The Palestinians would be in his army, of course, because Nebuchadnezzar had conquered, by this time, he had conquered Tyre as well as Sidon, as well as other places in Phoenicia. Continuing to the inscription from this unnamed high-ranking official, the Amu and the wretched northerners from the land of Sati, who we're going to take to be the Babylonians, they made an expedition to waste and plunder the upper country. That's upper Egypt, that's southern Egypt, right down near the Ethiopian border. So that was in their heart, the fear of his majesty. I'm assuming that's Amasis II or Amasis II. The fear of his majesty was slight with them. They caused to strengthen their heart with plans. I did not let them plunder as far as Nubia. Nubia is in Ethiopia, south of Egypt. I made them come near the place where his majesty was, and his majesty made a great carnage among them. So he starts bragging about beating the Babylonians. But before then, though, the Babylonians had come all the way down to the south. I say the Babylonians, the Sati, the people from the land of Sati, came down and wiped out his temple. Well, so this high official is bragging, but remember, people are always biased when they brag, but even this braggadocious inscription admits that the temple was destroyed down there. And if it was destroyed all the way in the south, that means the Babylonians had to invade the country, beating up on everybody as they came down to the south. As P. Thompson says, as we continue with his quote, he admits, this high-ranking official in the inscription admits, however, that the people from the Sati had ravaged the temple of Khnum at Elephantine. Elephantine's an island near Aswan, for he himself had repaired it. The invaders were defeated by the king with great slaughter, but not till they had passed Syene, that's Aswan, the point mentioned by Ezekiel. I think that's pretty good evidence, in my humble opinion. It doesn't explain the 40 years, though. Here's how P. Thompson deals with the 40 years of desolation. Prophets give numbers only as the vaguest estimates, and no doubt never meant themselves to be held strictly to definite figures. The Nile Valley may well have lain all but waste for a number of years during the confusions of the war, and this is all that is demanded by the prophecy. Well, I don't like that, vaguest estimates. I think if you're going to talk about the 40 years not being literal, I think it's better to go to the symbolic option to handle that. Well, let's look at another possible solution from Adam Clark. This is how he deals with it. He said the country from Migdal, which was on the isthmus between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, that's present day where the Suez Canal is, that country was so completely ruined that it might well be called desert, and it is probable that this desolation continued during the whole of the reign of Amasis, who ruled from 570 to 526, which was just 40 years, well, 43. Problem with that view is that Ezekiel says the destruction was going to be from Migdal to Aswan, and Clark doesn't mention Aswan. That's all the way down in the south. There was no complete destruction for 40 years all the way down in the south, or at least if there was, that's highly unlikely. So I'm going to ditch Clark's solution. Let's read what theology.web has to say. We may note that our sources for this period are very sparse, and the best that can really be said is that there is no positive evidence that Nebuchadnezzar took Egypt as prophesied. Well, I just read you some evidence. Well, what he's saying is no evidence that Nebuchadnezzar took Egypt as prophesied. In other words, by making a complete desolation, there is evidence that Babylon attacked Egypt, as I said. And Theology Web continues, extant records do indicate that Nebuchadnezzar did indeed conquer Egypt. Whether he took them into captivity and left Egypt desolate for 40 years is neither proven nor disproven by our sources. But the sources do indicate, as I've quoted from Wikipedia, that Nebuchadnezzar did attack Egypt, 568 or so. Theology.web continues, therefore, for lack of evidence, this prophecy cannot be judged a priori a failure. In other words, if you want to believe it's a failure, look to your worldview and say, I don't believe in the Bible, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in revelation, I don't believe in inspiration, I don't believe in inerrancy, or whatever your presuppositions are, and you say, okay, we don't have enough proof. But you can't prove me wrong when I say it did happen, when I go to my presuppositions, which are Ezekiel is a prophet of God, and he speaks the truth. Now let's look at the aforesaid Jim Riley. He's the guy that wrote a master's thesis at Dallas Seminary. His suggested chronology defies the conventional wisdom of historians, all of whom, or most of whom, deny the invasion of Egypt by Babylon ever occurred, at least never occurred, in as severe a form as Ezekiel prophesied. This thesis is 4 volumes long. Here are some high points. Riley says that when Ezekiel says no foot of man or animal shall pass through Egypt, it refers to a huge inundation of the Nile, which happened before the 40-year Egyptian desolation period, and so that flood would then make verse 11 literal. Verse 11 says no foot of man will pass through it because there was a big flood of the Nile. This is getting way out there, folks. And as I said, his main contribution, as far as I'm concerned, is he says that Babylon invaded Egypt in 564. I do not know his reasoning behind that. I know that Wikipedia and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they say it was 568. But 568 minus 40 gives you 528. Cambyses of Persia beat Egypt in 525. That's fairly close. So I personally, in my state of ignorance, am going to assume that Josephus was right. I'm going to assume that that piece of hieroglyphic evidence in the Louvre is referring to an invasion by Babylon. I'm going to assume it happened in the period of Amasis II before Cambyses took over conquering Egypt in the name of Persia. Now, however, because this is a difficult proof, there are people who take futurist interpretations. Now, here's what a futurist is. He's somebody that when he sees difficulties in the Old Testament prophecies, he immediately punts and says, well, we can't prove it now, so it must have happened in the future. But I say, most probably the reason you can't prove it now is just by reasons of accidents. The contemporary evidence is not there. Either other scriptural evidence or other secular evidence, it just happened to not be found yet. Somebody did dig in the right place to dig up the clay tablet that we need to prove it. So I don't see the point in punting to the future whenever things get difficult. But people do that, and unfortunately I lost the author who said this, but he's very typical. He reminds me of Tim LaHaye and Hal Lindsey. The critical part is verse 11, where it basically says nothing at all will be able to go from one side of Egypt to the other for 40 years. And of course, these futurists tend to be hyper-literal. Think of the day of the Lord, with the ancient prophets describing what they foresaw happening thousands of years ahead in the near-coming future, but only being able to use language and idioms of their day. Think of nuclear bombs. Then think of radioactivity killing all those who tried to cross Egypt from one side to the other. Think of God's plan to allow Israel to be brought to repentance by its enemies, and then look at the world news with God's perspective. Newspaper eschatology. I reject that with emphasis. In my humble opinion, I think that stuff is silly. I've read all of it. I was snookered by all of it. And I finally have come to see that most of it's based on speculation upon speculation upon speculation. And these are the same people that told me in my early Christian years, about 50 years ago, Henry Kissinger's the Antichrist. Muammar Gaddafi is the Antichrist. Mikhail Gorbachev is the Antichrist. See the little mark on his forehead? It's the mark of the beast. My favorite is Ronald Reagan is the Antichrist, because Ronald Wilson Reagan, if you add up the number of his name, it adds up to 666. Best president we ever had, and people are calling him the Antichrist, these futurists are. And folks, that wasn't just some off-the-wall thing. That was in a movie that I saw that. Sponsored by Campus Crusade for Christ, excuse me, crew, but they put it in a movie. They charged me money to go see that movie, and this is what I hear. that Ronald Reagan is the Antichrist. So we're not going to take a futurist interpretation. We're going to stick with a literal preterist interpretation so far. Now let's look at some other options. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the 40 years is not literal, it's rather symbolic. Quote, answering to the 40 years in which the Israelites, their former bondsmen, wandered in the wilderness. Jerome remarks the number 40 is one often connected with affliction and judgment. The rains of the flood in 40 days brought destruction on the world. Moses, Elias, and the Savior fasted 40 days. The ideal 40 years wilderness state of social and political degradation, rather than a literal non-passing of man or beast for that term, is mainly intended. Well, I hate to go the symbolic route, but I'd much rather go on that route than the futurist route. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown could be quite accurate about this, because it's hard to see how Nebuchadnezzar could have wiped out Egypt for 40 years, make it a wasteland, even if you take no foot shall pass on it as being exaggeration. Still, 40 years literally is kind of hard to see. So that might be the answer there. It's a 40-year period which is symbolic of desolation and waste. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown did mention the 40 days that Jesus fasted in the wilderness. You see the number 40 in the Bible, it means it's a period of time that's not good. Now here's another suggested solution to the problem of Egypt being desolated for 40 years. This view says that the prophecy is conditional. Let me read you from TheologyWeb.com. Except where a promise is confirmed by God's oath, we are safe in concluding that every statement of God about the future has some element of the conditional in it, something ancient Israel was as unwilling to believe as we are. A change of behavior can annul the prophecy. For example, this quotation doesn't mention it, but think of Jonah. Jonah's prophecy was conditional. You need to repent, Nineveh, and they did, and so God didn't wipe them out. Ellison notes, continue with my quote, Ellison notes in this regard Jeremiah 18:7-10. If at any time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be uprooted, torn down, and destroyed, and if that nation I warned repents of its evil, then I will relent and not inflict on it the disaster I had planned. And if at another time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be built up and planted, and if it does evil in my sight and does not obey me, then I will reconsider the good I had intended to do for it. Ellison therefore proposes that Ezekiel's prophecy was unfulfilled. I don't know who Ellison is. Ezekiel's prophecy was unfulfilled because of a change of behavior on the part of Egypt. Is there evidence of this? None that is clear. Although the sin of pride for which Egypt was convicted may well have been abandoned at the prospect of being shellacked by Nebuchadnezzar's army, the question remains an open one. Well, I think saying that the prophecy is conditional is just as speculative as speculating to when the 40 years literally are, because there's no proof that Egypt ever repented to keep the prophecy from happening. So I'm going to throw that one out. I've thrown the futurist suggestion out. I've held on to the symbolic interpretation for the 40 years, and I think that we may even be willing to go with 40 actual years between Nebuchadnezzar's attack on Egypt and Cambyses of Persia taking over Egypt in 525, and I'm going to take the 40 years as symbolic. Folks, I could very well be wrong on what I just told you, but I don't think anybody else knows either. So I'm going to leave that and move on to Ezekiel 29, verses 13 through 16. Yet this is what the Sovereign Lord says, at the end of 40 years I will gather the Egyptians from the nations where they were scattered. I will bring them back from captivity and return them to Upper Egypt, the land of their ancestry. Remember, Upper Egypt is Southern Egypt. There will be a lowly kingdom. It will be the lowliest of kingdoms and will never again exalt itself above the other nations. I will make it so weak that it will never again rule over the nations. Egypt will no longer be a source of confidence for the people of Israel, but will be a reminder of their sin in turning to her for help. Then they will know that I am the Sovereign Lord. In verse 13, the Persians had obviously scattered the Egyptians, or Nebuchadnezzar had, before the Persians showed up. They were scattered, then they came back. But even though they come back, there will be a lowly kingdom. Now, this is sort of easy because Egypt really was a lowly kingdom after 525. That's obvious from reading Egyptian history. Let me give you a quote from John Gill. Cyrus's son Cambyses, his son entered into it. That's entered into Egypt in 525, made sad devastation in it and an entire conquest of it. And though it revolted under Darius Hystaspes, it was subdued again and brought into a worse state than before by Xerxes. It revolted again in the reign of Darius Nothus And it was at last by Achish totally subdued. These are very different Dariuses, and I can't keep them straight. I can't remember. But if you read the history, Egypt was totally subdued by the Persians. And from that time, the Egyptians never had a king of their own nation to reign over them, because after the Persians came the Ptolemies, the successor to Alexander the Great. And Egypt under the Ptolemies was never as great as it was before when it had independent pharaohs. In fact, the Ptolemies were essentially subject to the Roman Empire. Along with the Persian Empire, I'll continue quoting from Gill, Egypt came into the hands of Alexander without any opposition. That's when Alexander came down there and established Alexandria, went off into the desert, forgot the name of the place, where it is alleged that he received a word from an oracle saying he was a god, and historians debate, but maybe he really believed that. But all of that happened 332 to 323, actually in the 330s, when Alexander came down to Egypt. After Egypt's death, Egypt fell to the share of Ptolemy, one of his captains, one of Alexander's captains. And though some of the first kings of that name were of considerable note and power, yet Egypt made a poor figure under the reigns of several of them. When the Roman Empire obtained, it became a province of that. Egypt became a province of Rome and continued so for 600 or 700 years, and then it fell into the hands of the Saracens, that means the Muslims, when it sunk into ignorance and superstition, that 7th century A.D., the Mahometan religion being established in it, with whom it continued until about the year of Christ 1250, when the Mamelukes, or Turkish and Carcassian, I don't know what Carcassian means, I know what the Mamelukes are, the slaves, rose up against their sovereigns, the sultans of Egypt, and usurped the government, in whose hands it was until the year 1517, when Selim the Ninth, Emperor of the Turks, conquered the Mamelukes and put an end to their government and annexed it to the Ottoman Empire, of which it is a province to this day. Now, this is the 19th century. Well, we know the Ottoman Empire became the sick man of Europe and was busted up into pieces after World War I. I'll carry it on beyond Gill into the 20th century. So, Egypt never came back. Verse 15, it will be the lowliest of kingdoms. Never again exalt itself above the other nations. I will make it so weak that it will never again rule over the nations. And that's the way it's been. We go now to Ezekiel 29, verse 17. In the 27th year, in the first month, on the first day, the word of the Lord came to me. Now, this is 17 years later than the prophecy we were just looking at. In verse 1 of this chapter, we see a prophecy against Egypt given in the 10th year. That's the 10th year of Ezekiel's captivity, the 10th year since Zedekiah was put on the throne by the Babylonians, 597. So the prophecy against Egypt was roughly 587, 586. Now we're talking about 597 minus 27 down to 570. So we're 17 or so years later, and we have another prophecy. And this prophecy, although 17 years later in time, is still against the nation of Egypt. We read in verse 18, Ezekiel 29, as we continue, Yahweh continues, Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, drove his army in a hard campaign against Tyre. Every head was rubbed bare and every shoulder made raw, yet he and his army got no reward from the campaign he led against Tyre. Now this is easy to interpret. Nebuchadnezzar besieged Tyre between 586 and 573. Those dates are hard. Everybody agrees on that. As John Gill says, besieging it 13 years before he was able to take it, during which time his army suffered much hardship, was greatly fatigued and wearied by the various military works they were engaged in to carry on the siege so long a time. They finally got the Tyrians to submit, but they never destroyed the city. At least they didn't destroy New Tyre. They built a causeway out to the island New Tyre, and Nebuchadnezzar couldn't figure out how to get out there. I think he tried to put some rocks down, but wasn't able to make it. Ezekiel says in verse 18 that Nebuchadnezzar's soldiers had their heads rubbed bare and their shoulders made raw. As Gill says, the heads of the soldiers became bald with wearing their helmets so long, or carrying baskets of earth and timber upon their heads to make mounds with, and the skin of their shoulders was peeled off, either with their armor or by carrying burdens on them for the purpose of making the causeway. I'm paraphrasing Gill here. Or, as Jerome says, from the Assyrian annals, to make a causeway to join the island to the continent, that so they might come to it with their battering rams and demolish it, which they failed to do. Alexander, a century and a half later, was able to do that, but not Nebuchadnezzar. And we are talking about Nebuchadnezzar because verse 18 mentions Nebuchadnezzar. Adam Clark says of these soldiers having their heads rubbed bare and their soldiers and their shoulders made raw. Clark says, being continually on duty, their heads became bald by wearing their helmets and their shoulders bruised and peeled by carrying baskets of earth to the fortifications. Now, Ezekiel says, Yahweh says that Nebuchadnezzar and his army got no reward from the campaign. That doesn't mean that Nebuchadnezzar failed in the siege. He didn't. He won the siege, but he got no reward. How was that? Well, let's read John Gill again. When the Tyrians found that the city was like to be taken by Nebuchadnezzar, their gold and silver and whatsoever was valuable that was with them, they put on and sent it to other islands, or as others say, that when Tyre on the continent, which was what Nebuchadnezzar besieged, that's old Tyre, was about to be taken, the inhabitants transplanted their riches to the island at some distance, that's New Tyre, where New Tyre was afterwards built. However, what with the consumption of their riches during this 13-year siege and the removing their effects to other places before the taking of the city, there was scarce anything left for the plunder of King of Babylon's army, so that he had nothing to requite them. He didn't have any plunder to give to the army because the people of Tyre had squirreled their possessions away either in a different city, some people say Carthage, or on the island of New Tyre. Adam Clark says this, the Tyrians, finding it at last impossible to defend their city against Nebuchadnezzar, and we're roughly around 573 now, the Tyrians put all their wealth aboard their vessels, sailed out of the port, and escaped for Carthage. And thus Nebuchadnezzar lost all the spoil of one of the richest cities in the world. Either they went to Carthage or they went to New Tyre. I think the sources are unclear there. We go now to Ezekiel 29, verses 19 through 20. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am going to give Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he will carry off its wealth. He will loot and plunder the land as pay for his army. I have given him Egypt as a reward for his efforts because he and his army did it for me, declares the sovereign Lord. Therefore is there for this reason. Since Tyre was a bust, Nebuchadnezzar, I'm going to give you Egypt as a consolation prize. Therefore, because your soldiers' heads and arms were rubbed sore, and you spent 13 years besieging the city, and then the Tyrians took off with all their wealth so you don't have any plunder. Therefore, despite all that bad stuff, and because of all that bad stuff, God is going to give you Egypt as a consolation prize. And Nebuchadnezzar will carry off the wealth of Egypt. He will loot and plunder the land as pay for his army. So now Nebuchadnezzar can catch up the arrears and pay that must have occurred as his army spent 13 years besieging Tyre. Verse 20, God says, I have given Nebuchadnezzar Egypt as a reward for his efforts because he and his army did it for me. Did what for God? Nebuchadnezzar didn't do anything intentionally for God, of course, but when he besieged Tyre and Egypt for himself, he was doing God's will. Unwittingly, he was doing God's will. Happens a lot. We go now to the last verse in this chapter, Ezekiel 29, verse 21. On that day, I will make a horn grow for the house of Israel, Yahweh continues, and I will open your mouth among them. Then they will know that I am the Lord. Now, on that day is a loose time reference. As Benson says, the phrase frequently denotes in the prophets not the same time which was last mentioned, but an extraordinary season, remarkable for some signal events of providence. In this sense, it is to be understood here. Well, you can say in the times of Nebuchadnezzar, who came in and made Egypt a wasteland, God's going to make a horn grow for the house of Israel. A horn is a symbol of strength, just like a horn grows on the head of an animal. Remember, Israel was in Babylon during this time, as Nebuchadnezzar comes in. If Nebuchadnezzar came to Egypt in 568, and the Israelites left Babylon in 538 or so, that's 30 years or so, time for the horn to grow. The house of Israel can grow stronger and stronger, resulting finally in the return in 538 and 37. So that is the time that Benson and Clark say the day is referring to. The day of the return, 538, 537, after the edict of Cyrus the Great, saying, Jews, you can go back to your homeland because we've beaten the Babylonians and you will no longer be enslaved to the Babylonians. Now, there's a couple other options as to what that horn is. What does it refer to? Cambridge and Ellicott say that the horn growing is Nebuchadnezzar humbling Egypt. And during that time of humbling Egypt, 568 to 525, Daniel was advanced in the king of Babylon. Poole says that. Or it could be Jehoiachin was let out of prison. He was let out around 560. That's in the general time frame here that Babylon is attacking Egypt. Jehoiachin was let out by evil Merodach, and Jehoiachin had his throne set above the thrones of all the other captive kings in Babylon. Interesting little point about that. I had a seminary professor point out to me that the last book in the Hebrew Bible canon is Second Chronicles, or what they call Chronicles, and the last story was Jehoiachin being set up above all the other kings in Babylon, and this was to be a harbinger of the reestablishment of the house of David. And the Jews put that there because they wanted to see the house of David restored, Jehoiachin being the last king of the house of David. And of course, we know that the house of David was restored unto Jesus. That's kind of interesting. But at any rate, this horn could refer to Daniel being a big shot in Babylon during this time, with Jehoiachin being let out of prison. Or it could refer to the end of that period when the Jews actually return to Jerusalem. Now, some people say, option number three, the horn is referring to when Israel will flourish under the Messiah in the times of Jesus, but I think that is too far ahead of where we are now, so I don't think that's what Elijah was talking about. I'm sure that some people think that. And as that horn grows, God says, I will open your mouth among them. In other words, Ezekiel is going to be prophesying amongst the exiles in Babylon, in Babylonia. He's going to continue to give them prophecies concerning their growing strength. John Gill says we have no record of those prophecies. Well, I don't know. We haven't finished the book yet. Who knows what we might find? Adam Clark says it might be somebody besides Daniel or Jehoiachin, whom I've already mentioned. Adam Clark says it might be Mordecai, who's about a century later under King Xerxes of Persia in the book of Esther. I don't think so. It's too far in the future, in my humble opinion. I think it's talking about the return and possibly the events that happened in Babylon, which were strengthening Israel, namely the rise of Daniel, the freeing of Jehoiachin. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished this very difficult chapter, and we are now ready to go to our next chapter, which is Ezekiel 30, which I will entitle A Lament for Egypt. It's interesting that when Ezekiel prophesied against Tyre, he took one chapter to prophesy against the city. The next chapter was a lament for the city, and the next chapter was a prophecy against the king of the city. Same thing with Egypt here. We start out in chapter 29 with a prophecy against the nation of Egypt. In our next chapter, chapter 30, we will see a lament for Egypt. And in chapter 31, we will see a prophecy against the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you continue with me in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.